Okay, good afternoon, everybody. First off, before I get this whole thing started, just a quick question. How many of you actually have Azure being used right now? Just raise your hands. So there's a good group of you in here. And how many of you have an idea of how to estimate how much anything that you're about to do is going to wind up costing your company next month? Just a couple. Okay, so we got a few. All right. The reason why I ask is I'm just trying to get an idea of how, you know, what the audience all knows. Couple words of warning while this presentation starts. I have a new laptop here. It has some driver incompatibility issues that I'm still trying to work out. As a result, if this thing blue screens during the presentation, know I have an SSD on here, which means it will reboot in about 15 seconds, but that the thing may happen. I already had it happen to me once yesterday during a presentation. I expect I may get hit again today. If I was back in the States, I would have grabbed one of my other laptops, brought that along. Guess what? About 7,000 kilometers away from my nearest laptop. So just give you a heads up, if that happens, be warned. So this talk is, this costs what? Estimating costs in the Azure cloud. Turn this thing on. A little bit about myself before we get too far into this. My name's Scott Seeley. I'm a regional director in the United States, the Chicago area. Job of a regional director is it's an honorary title, first of all, so I do not work for Microsoft. I'm an independent consultant, run my own company. I'm also a connected systems MVP, and prior to doing those couple things, I used to work at Microsoft. From 2002 to 2006, I was on the WCF team, and the features I was responsible for, please don't throw any eggs, I'm the guy who wrote the configuration system. Really. The developer, I had no architects around me. What I try to tell people is that if you ever had the dishonor of getting the 2003 bits when they sent them out at a PDC, you may remember that your configuration for any individual service was on the order of 50 lines of XML. I managed to get that down to about 8. So again, my apologies. The other thing that you might love me for is I also wrote the tracing configuration system. So the tracing system, so if you've ever had to figure out what's going on inside the black box, all the traces, all the use cases, all the begin-end boundaries inside the tracing, that was me too. I spent 2 years trying to figure out how that should work out and writing lots and lots of unit tests to make sure it consistently worked. Anyhow, that's a bit about me, has nothing to do with Azure. What we want to cover today is we want to cover some basic notions. So set the groundwork and describe what is a distributed application. Most of us have an idea of what these are. I just want to kind of say what we're talking about in this particular context. Then do a little bit of a reality check and talk about the realities of these data centers and how much they cost to build. I've been talking to fairly small data centers operations that might only have 50 or 60 computers in their organization that are being used to drive lots and lots of transactions, and I've been discovering some costs that are fairly high. And not only that, but the cost of running these things are fairly big. Just want to kind of remind everybody how much this stuff costs as well. And then we'll look at cost-oriented architecture. With cost-oriented architecture, a lot of the stuff you'll be looking at is what does each operation that I design, how should it work to minimize cost and maximize value? When you're talking about Azure, you're trying to present it to your company and explain to them, look, if we go to Azure, this is going to be a really good idea. You don't want to just tell them that this thing is going to cost them, let's say, $24,000 a year in extra costs. Instead, you also want to be able to describe to your CEO, your CFO, everybody else at the C-level type stuff, what is this going to give your company? When you're looking at Azure, please, and the big thing here is don't look at just the cost. Look at what else you can do with this that you can't do today. With Azure, one of the things you can do is when demand goes up, you can allocate, provision, install 20 machines in about 15 minutes. Can you buy, provision, install 20 machines in 15 minutes in your current infrastructure? If you can't, you'll see an advantage where Azure can give you some advantages. And not only that, but also understand that Azure can give you these advantages even if you primarily use a data center and want to use Azure as a place for you to scale out. And then finally, we'll close out by how would you architect for cost on Azure? In general, it's about how do you be smart about what you're doing. Azure charges for these things called transactions. They call them transactions. The reality is that they're an API call. Every time you place a REST API call into Azure, they charge you. It's not a lot. 1/10,000th of a penny per API call. If you execute, If you execute one transaction every 100 milliseconds for an entire month, that's $25.92. You can execute quite a bit of code on Azure and get and not be charged a whole lot of money. So let's first talk about these distributed applications and some of the generalities that we know about them. First off, we know that a lot of times we have a web server involved. The web server is involved with talking to the internet, making sure that other people can access our applications. There's a back-end part that does work. A lot of times the back-end part is the part where you'll have more engineers than on the web front end. The back-end part will do things like rolling up reports, billing to customers, or just doing the real work that your application needs to do, where the web role passes something off to the worker to get work done. You've typically got a number of data sources sitting somewhere in your application infrastructure, and you've got a lot of files. All of these things cost money. By the way, the other thing you have to worry about is memory. If you're billing applications that are distributed apps, you will get to a point where you need to install some sort of a caching infrastructure. Typically, what you'll see is people will buy, if you're in the .NET platform or any platform, a lot of folks buy Memcached. Not buy Memcached, they buy servers dedicated to Memcached. Any caching server is basically a box where you put in a fast enough CPU, a lot of memory, and a really small hard disk. The hard disk only needs to be able to boot the box. The rest of that machine's life, it's just serving up requests out of memory. Finally, you're going to need something that secures this whole bit as well. You want to be able to be secured in some unified manner where every time you add a new application or a new bit of functionality, it can plug into your existing infrastructure. These are things you're going to build no matter what kind of distributed application you make, no matter where that thing lives. If it lives in your enterprise, you want to make sure that only authenticated users get in. If it lives on the internet, you want to make sure that only paying customers get in. What will happen again is you have folks like these paying customers, they enter through the web and they do their thing. The bit that really gets me about this is that all of this stuff is very, very expensive. I was talking to a customer of mine that lives in northern Wisconsin. It's in the middle of nowhere. Their infrastructure costs are fairly low. Their whole cost infrastructure is low because they're in the middle of a fairly rural area. Even then, what they had to do is, first off, let's talk about their infrastructure. They've got 15 racks of equipment sitting in their data center. It's all running Windows. On this, they have 35 database servers, a bunch of web servers, a bunch of worker servers, and about 500 terabytes of storage. Beyond all this, they also have to worry about things like, do they have redundant power? Do they have enough cooling? Do they have enough stuff for tape backup? Because, as we know, hard disks are fast, but tapes don't fail as often. Tapes can be stored for a much longer period of time. They had to worry about making sure their network was all working. All this infrastructure they had to have in place. This bit here does not include disaster recovery site, which has to be more or less the exact same thing. The cost for this data center was $3 million US. If you want to visualize how big the data center is and how much room this rack took up, it wasn't very much to go through $3 million. We're literally talking about four rows of chairs from the middle out to the edge of the chairs. That's how much space $3 million took up. For $3 million, you can get an awful lot of space somewhere else and rent it. And the other thing that happens with this is that they own this, which means that when it fails, when it has to be updated, when the machines just get out of date, they have to spend that $3 million again. And as we know, whenever you upgrade, you wind up buying machines that cost about the same for whatever you're doing. Again, not trying to say that data centers are expensive. We all knew that. Just trying to remind you that when we're looking at Azure, and when you start seeing that maybe when you calculate everything out, that your total bill for Azure might be $500,000 a year, that's not so bad. And this number here does not mention the operational costs at all. This particular company had a staff of 7 people, 5 of which were dedicated to just the care and feeding of this system, replacing broken parts because they had 500 terabytes of hard drive on 150 gigabyte hard drives, so you need a lot of hard drives to keep that up and running. People monitoring the software to make sure that things were staying afloat, making sure that all the connectivity was working. And so, again, there's probably another $1 million in expenses just on keeping the thing running from year to year in people alone. Because of these expenses, because of the need to be able to scale out, and because of the fact that when you buy for your worst case demand, you have a lot of resources sitting idle, we have this thing that a lot of people started using called the cloud. Amazon actually built out when they first started by knowing that they would have to be able to satisfy the Christmas season, which is the busiest buying season in most parts of the world. The rest of the year, like in the middle of summer, people aren't buying as much, and they would have a bunch of unused capacity sitting around. The cloud helps you deal with that unused capacity and helps people provide machines and computing power so that you can use this. Again, you're in an Azure talk, so you've already drank that Kool-Aid, and you understand it's a good thing. Nice thing about the cloud is that there are no capital expenditures, no data center, no servers, no power, no cooling, no network, none of these things that you have to pay for. Instead, what happens is the business that provides these has to find a model where they charge you for these bits. Another nice thing about this is that your personnel inside your organization can focus on the things that are actually important to your business. Instead of having IT guys who are hired to replace hard drives, you can have IT people who are focused on making sure that your monitoring software is up and running so that when demand spikes, you know to allocate more machines, you know, to increase the limits that you're allowing Azure to go to, that know how to take to do offsite backups. Because so everybody hear about the news that happened with Amazon last week? So about half the audience hadn't. What happened with Amazon is Amazon told everybody out there that their cloud will, that their applications will not fail if they allocate their applications to one availability zone and to a second availability zone. Now, keep in mind, I am not picking on Amazon. Microsoft can have these failures too. As a matter of fact, they've had some issues in the past with their storage. Just taking Amazon as a recent example. So what Amazon did is they said if you allocate to two separate availability zones, your applications should continue to run. Lots of companies did this, companies that you've heard of, like Foursquare or Reddit or Quora. They all said, we will do that. The thing that Amazon didn't look into is that they still had a single point of failure, which is their elastic block storage. Elastic block storage is where they kept the images for the virtual machines. When you tried spinning up, so when the elastic block store went down, if you're in availability zone 1 and availability zone 2, and they can't get to their VM image, they can't start. Other types of failures are going to happen in the cloud as well. You want your IT people to be focused on things like, how do I make sure that I bring the data in-house? How do I replicate it somewhere else? Now, there are strategies that Microsoft handles for making sure that you have two volume, you know, your data is redundantly copied. But still, a lot of people say that if you aren't moving your stuff from one provider to another on a regular basis, at least your key data, you're jeopardizing your business. So you will still need to worry about this. Your key IT people can spend their time worrying about disaster recovery and not worrying about just keeping things running. The other thing that you get with the cloud, obviously, is that they charge for usage. So they watch what you're doing, figure out how much to bill for it, and then they write out bills. Because of this notion of going to the cloud, a lot of folks have been asked now, how do I actually architect applications to minimize cost and maximize utility? And that's a key thing to remember here. I'm not just going after, or whenever I'm building applications on Azure, I'm not trying to do this the cheapest way possible. I'm trying to do it the smartest way possible, which means that if there are two ways to do things and one of them costs less, I pick the cheaper one. If there are two ways to do things and one of them causes me to fail on an edge case, I will do the one that doesn't cause me to fail on the edge case. Again, it's about being smart about your architecture. A lot of cases, though, inside of Azure, it really doesn't matter what you do. For example, with bandwidth, ingress and egress, here what you want to do is you want to be understanding of what data you're sending in, what data you're getting out. Azure charges for this stuff. Azure charges for data. They charge per gigabyte stored. And in SQL Azure, they charge on the size of the database. One of the things you'll find here is that some people will say, I need to work with SQL Azure, or I need to work with table storage. An interesting thing between SQL Azure and table storage is that the table storage charges you 15 cents per gigabyte per month for storage. SQL Azure charges you $10 per gigabyte per month. So it's a huge cost difference. But if your data needs relational integrity, if you need all the benefits that a transactional database gives you, you pick SQL Azure because it's the smart choice. If you're storing logging data, if you're storing lots and lots of information about audits, like history records saying what did the record look like here, what does it look like now, maybe you want to store that in table storage instead because it's cheaper to access. On the other hand, if you're accessing data real frequently, maybe you're executing millions of transactions against the row per month, then all of a sudden the SQL Azure can become the cheaper option. Again, it's understand what you're doing with the data. As I mentioned before, there are these things called transactions in the documentation. They're really API calls. Every time you execute a call against the client libraries inside of Azure, you're more or less doing an API call, at least anything that does work. Obviously, calling a constructor does not do work on Azure. Here you're charged by the number of these, and we'll get into the actual costs in a bit. Typically, the transactions are like a read or write to storage. So every time someone gets a resource, like you have an image stored in blob storage and you download it to your web page, that's a transaction. And then finally, there's these compute resources that you can also plan against. And here the compute resources are based on the size of the machine and the hours that you use that machine. When you need more computers, you rent more compute units, things go faster. General guidelines, again, like I said, is you want to optimize for, when you choose to optimize for cost, that's usually a bad path. Your CEO will not want to hear that the transactions or the user experience degraded, but I saved you a nickel. You may have cost them hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars because of a bad design decision. So never ever optimize for cost. Instead, optimize for your agility. Can you allocate more machines on demand when suddenly, you put out a press release or something else, execute a special offer on your website, lots of people are going to show up. If you can architect your application such that just bring in more web roles or more worker roles makes everything happy and continue to fly along at the normal pace for your average user, like let's say your delivery guidelines are send out a web page within 1 second, those are the types of guidelines that you want to focus on primarily. And then within those things, watch out and make things cheaper. First thing I want to look at then is the compute storage. With the compute storage, we have 5 different machine options. There's the extra small option through the extra large option. The thing I want to highlight here for you is when you look at the size of these instances, they all scale linearly. So I go from small to extra large, I go from 1 shared compute unit to 8. They double all along the way, and their memory also increases along the way linearly. Ditto for the storage. The reason why this is important to understand is because some of your algorithms may benefit from having multiple cores. So instead of allocating 2 machines and having a single core, maybe you're better off having 1 machine that runs the 2 tasks in parallel because of some other optimizations you can make up. If you can do a lot of things that make use of the memory on the machine, the file storage on the machine, and you have communicating processes, sometimes it'll make sense to locate those processes on the same box and just buy a more powerful machine. As I said, these things scale linearly. So for every time you add a core, assume times 12 cents. The small machine is 12 cents. The extra large is 96 cents an hour. If you really need 8 cores to get your work done, and you can get it done faster by letting things talk to each other on the same machine instead of having to send messages across the Azure network, pick the extra large instance. Again, it's more about, again, what we're trying to do here is say, how much does this stuff cost? How do I architect for it? With the compute stuff, like I said, I recommend that if you can do things where you communicate via either inter-process communication, such as name pipes, file-based storage, or something that's located on the same machine, feel free to use that kind of stuff. When you can, also, another nice thing is that when you can communicate back and forth between roles, instead of having this communication pattern where you drop everything into a queue, sometimes it might make sense to co-locate these different workers on the same machine, buy a beefier box, like I said, have them talk back and forth. The other place where this makes a lot of sense is if you have a highly asynchronous model. For example, let's say that you're using the queue storage fairly heavily, and you want to be able to process more messages. There are some things that are, because you're charged per transaction for queue messages, if you're processing millions of queue messages per day, you may be better off going with a beefier box that can handle more of these simultaneously. It may in the end be cheaper for you. Again, run the numbers and figure it out. So that's the little bit on how you would think about the storage side. About the compute side. Now with storage transactions, first thing to understand here is that, again, every time you make a REST API call, that's what Microsoft is calling a transaction. You're allowed 10,000 of these for every penny. Yes, they do amortize these, so if you execute 5,000, you owe them half a penny. The other thing here is that with storage, they charge 15 to 20 cents per gigabyte to send the information out. it's 15 cents if you're anywhere but Asia. In Asia, the storage and the sending data out to the outside world is 20 cents per gigabyte. I have no idea why it's 33% more expensive there, but it seems that everybody, all the cloud providers, charge you extra if you're sending data throughout Asia. The data operations that cost money then, when you're looking at what's going to cost you, is if I send information from Internet Explorer or from just think like outside of Azure into the cloud, I'm going to get charged for bandwidth. So if the cloud is sending me a picture, if I'm sending data in, I'm going to get charged. Ingress charges are 10 cents per gigabyte. Egress is 15, or like I said, 20 in Asia. Any data that's going in between the web role and, say, blob storage, I can get charged for any API calls I'm doing, but the bandwidth is free. Because I'm in Azure, talking to Azure, they do not monitor the switches between the different machines inside the data center. And again, like I said, for the blob, if this blob's coming back to Internet Explorer, showing that image, I get charged once for showing the image, a second time for the bandwidth. The incremental cost of each image and stuff, not very expensive. It's not going to kill you. But again, what you want to do here then is you want to do some estimations to figure out how many page views do I expect per month on this particular page, how many images are on it, and how much data will I wind up sending down. Some of the things that people are doing to help optimize for these costs, particularly with images, because right away you might be thinking to yourself, on my web page on an average day, or on an average web page, I've got maybe 15 images. In those cases, you might want to be starting to think about using things like sprite-based images on your web pages so that you have the CSS that adjusts the image to show just the right thing. It'll actually speed up your performance in your application as well by using sprites. Everybody here familiar with using sprites as well? No? So we got a few. Idea behind a sprite is I've got a rectangle. On this rectangle, I have, let's say, layouts for different buttons on my navigation. Instead of downloading one image per button, I put all five button images in one sprite, and then I write CSS that offsets the image to only show the part that I want to have for each button. Now, if you want to learn more about sprites and such, Yahoo has some really good information about doing this. If you get, there's some performance tools that load up into Firefox from Yahoo that will help you figure out why your application is running slowly. It's actually called YSLOW, or YSLOW. Next thing to think about then are these queue transaction batch sizes. With queues, what you're going to see is that every time you do a put or delete, you get one transaction per message. If I do, and you'll be charged that pretty much no matter what. If I do I can also do a get or a peek. When I do a get or a peek, I can get up to 32 messages in one transaction. I say up to 32. What you're going to find when you're running on your local system against the development storage, you will always get 32 messages if there are 32 in storage. When you're running against Azure, you'll get some number between 1 and 32. You'll rarely get 32, even if the queue is loaded. It's just an interesting side effect. It's something I've been seeing over and over again. And it hasn't changed. When I was running experiments last Saturday, I was still seeing that if I ran against local storage, I'd always fill up my message. If I ran against Azure, I would never get all 32 messages. And what you want to do here is you want to get as many as possible. This is why I was saying that you may want to go ahead and for your worker role, if you're getting lots and lots of queued messages, it may be less expensive to buy a beefier instance and have it get more messages at once. Because yes, you'll pay more per hour for that instance, but you'll pay less on your transactions. And if you're grabbing one batch of transactions every, say, 10 milliseconds, this can wind up being fairly fast. When you're looking at this, then you can drop your average transaction count from anywhere between 2.03 transactions per message and 3 per message. If I'm only getting one message at a time, then my average count will be 3. If I'm grabbing them in batches, I can drive that cost down to almost nothing. And again, this is what I was saying about being smart when you're architecting your applications. Make sure that any queue processing tries to grab things in batches. The cost then on here is that if you were to do something like polling every 100 milliseconds, yes, you will get a perceived result to your customers that it looks like you're very fast, but you'll also be running about $26 per month just to check the queue. If no one sent you a message the entire month and you polled once every 100 milliseconds, things would be bad. Instead, what you probably want to do is look at the queue every 1 second, and then as long as you're getting messages out of the queue, drain the thing. So I just want to show a little demo of what that would look like. It's a 100% manufactured demonstration. Let's go up here. You set to start a project. We'll talk through what this whole thing does for as soon as I get these things running. So guys, oh, got this all set up. So I just need to do. There we go. Okay, so what I've got here is I've got two projects. One of them is a what I call blob processor. It's a poorly named one. This one's actually going to be processing the queue. And what we're going to be doing in here is as we look in the queue, we're going to sleep for 100 milliseconds, try to get a message. If we got one, we're going to process the message. And for our processing purposes, to just to show something, I'm going to put something out to the debug output panel, just saying, I got the message, what was the text? Okay? Again, it's fairly straightforward, trying to demonstrate how would you make the scale, not what would you do, you know, for a real workload, trying to minimize the different points to look at. I then have a queue populator. What the queue populator does is it sets up 200 indexes fairly quickly and then pounds a bunch of messages into the queue in parallel. So I'm just going to be sending these in as fast as possible. What happens when I typically run this is that I'll see that the population part is going to finish long before my application even starts up. But so we go here, press F5, what we're going to see happen is that while this thing's running, it's going to process all the messages in my queue fairly nicely, but let's go down here, control end. But what you're going to see also is that it's executing, it's grabbing all the messages, and it's probably not doing anything as efficient as it possibly could. And so here we see that it's just grabbing, you know, each of the messages that were popped into the queue. The count in front is just a little indicator saying how many have I processed so far, because I know they may not be coming in the same order they were, I may not be reading them in the same order they were sent. And again, I sent them as a parallel thing, which meant that it was all kind of just going as fast as possible. And it's going to spit out all 200 of these, but again, when we're doing this, we get 200 different transactions. So let this one kind of drain. And what we're going to do is we'll go back and implement something that's a little bit more efficient. So now it's just here spinning, costing us as much money as it possibly can. So if I want to, instead what I could do is I could go back here into my processor. I go into my worker role and I say, you know what? One of the things I know for certain is that if I grab the messages, there's another overload here that I can execute that will allow me to grab the messages in bulk. And so instead I'll say I want to get messages. IntelliSense. Get messages. And I've got a constant set up here which remembers that Azure allows me to get up to 32 at a crack. So I say get messages to get. And that part looks good. So now I'm getting as many as I possibly can. But now what I want to do is I want to make sure that the sleep here is not present, because I actually want to drain the queue also as fast as I possibly can. That's my real goal, is to make it look as responsive as possible. So I'll say if, let's say we'll call this one messages now. We'll say if messages is not equal to null and messages.count is greater than zero. And here we'll do the else case, which is, so when we don't find anything, what we want to do is we probably want to pause. We don't want to be doing this busy wait. And so instead of executing 10 transactions per second, let's slow it down by quite a bit and do a, so thread.sleep. And we'll actually ping it, like, say, every 5 seconds. So thread.sleep times span dot from seconds, and we'll say 5. Okay, so that's great, but now we don't have anything to actually process these messages. And again, I said I want to process these things as fast as possible. Because I'm able to buy machines that have multiple cores, I probably want to execute all these different messages in parallel and do whatever processing I would normally do. So instead of doing this, I would do a parallel and my spelling stinks today. There we go. For each, and for here I want to say for each of the messages, take a message and do the following. And what we're going to do is we're just going to take this and say, tell it to delete the message here. Message string. And now we've got a little case here, which is there's a potential race condition as well. So we'll do something like an interlocked.increment messages so far. And now what we can do here is, it's the point here being that I had a block of work that I was doing. By using some of the parallelism that's built in, by also using the fact that I can grab these messages in a big chunk, I can make sure that I'm processing these things as fast as possible and executing as few transactions as possible. So again, we run. There's a build error. And let's figure out what that one was. And what happened there is that the deployment actually, it sent all the 200 messages into the queue. And now what we're seeing here is that this thing is going to the working state only once the queue was drained. Make sense? So we send in 200 messages, and now it's sleeping for 5 seconds. But in the meantime, it was able to grab these fairly quickly. The other thing you're seeing in here is that it went through the 32. So this is every time it went through the loop, it wrote out the working. But now it's paused because there's nothing in there. We're not executing as many transactions. And when we went to go grab the data out of the queue, we were minimizing the number of calls we were doing out to the queue, which minimized our API costs. Okay? Next thing to talk about then is file transaction batch sizes. Again, you're being charged for every time you upload, you do these things. So one of the things you want to do is you want to make sure that you're minimizing the amount that you're spending when you're uploading files or downloading them. Pages and blocks themselves are both sent up in units between 0 and 4 megabytes. 4 megabytes is the biggest block that you can send up at once. What you want to do is you want to maximize this value whenever you're sending files up to the cloud, or whenever you're sending them within the cloud and you're just trying to commit something to blob storage. The most blocks also that you can commit at once is 50,000 blocks. So you can build up a large list before you commit everything. Again, we're trying to minimize what we're committing. Here, 50,000 is a big number. So you have to look at your overall, how fast are you uploading things? What's your average latency? What's the likelihood of something failing in your application? And then based on that, you may not want to commit in 50,000 size blocks. It might make more sense for your application to commit every 10 or every 500. Again, it depends. How big are the files that you're sending up, and what do you need to do? Now, I do know that some of you will be uploading files that are, 50,000 4-megabyte blocks. I've talked to a lot of companies who are between utilities and folks who do printing. I would say they both together do some of the biggest files. Printers will send up 4-gigabyte files because they're trying to print a 5-foot by 6-foot poster size drawing. Utilities tend to do this because they have a lot of data that they're collecting, and they keep it all in one file for transmission between point A and point B. In both those cases, you don't want to lose stuff because, again, the cost of losing the block means you have to start the upload again if you forgot where you're at. And so, again, you're trying to minimize costs. So just watch what your failure rates are. You can commit 50,000 blocks at once. You may not always want to do that. When people are retrieving the blocks back down, they can do things also to only get the active pages. Azure, when it first launched, supported the notion of I upload a block, I put it in place. In later releases, Azure also supports the notion of streams. Let's look at a file stream. Think that I want to write to bytes 505 through 910. You can do that with Azure. You upload a file, you upload just those bytes that you're interested in, and you can put it in place. What Azure then remembers is that if the total file looks like it's 1 terabyte in size, but only a few dozen of the pages in that 1 terabyte are populated, you can ask Azure, only give me the pages that have been populated. Don't download 2 terabytes of mostly zeros. Again, for the stuff, you get 1 transaction per fetch from storage. And one of the things I want to show you now is that when you are doing these fetches, when you're uploading storage or downloading, you don't have to do the math on your own. Azure actually knows how to do this for you. So we'll go from here. I've got a little application called the Blob Uploader. We'll set that as a startup project. What the Blob Uploader does is, again, a fairly simplistic operation. Should got open. Close everything else. So what we're going to do here is, well, application's good. Let's just kind of step through and we'll talk through what everything means as we get to the various lines. So I start out here. I've got a storage account. I'm going to open up the storage account. Right now, the account I'm using in is local storage. Reason why I'm using my local storage as opposed to Azure, was planning on actually using Azure for this. However, after seeing the keynote this morning, I changed my mind. Just seemed like a bad idea. Talked to Wade a little bit afterwards, too, and he said, yeah, wishes his demo he couldn't do like this one because there was no local version of the caching service. So anyhow, go here. We create our blob client like you normally would. And the first thing I do is I get a reference for the Tech Days container. If the container doesn't exist, I create it. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into a folder that I have, and I'm going to back up that folder. So we've got a folder sitting out here, again, using Dropbox, primarily so that in case anything I lose, if this computer flakes out on me, I've got a place to go get the data again. And it's got a basic, you know, it's got my slides in it. We've got, you know, the demos and all those files. And what we're going to do is we're going to parse through all this stuff and build up some names into the blob storage. In order to get this to work, we will, let's see, just go down to enumerate directories, which is going to be the interesting part. So set the breakpoint there. And what we're going to do is, there's this function that you can call when you're uploading a file. If you already have it on disk or you already have the file in memory somewhere, you can pass in a stream. And this upload from stream, what it will do is it will actually upload the file for you or the block of memory for you, and it will do everything in parallel that it can. And it will break along those 4 megabyte lines as well. So you can write code that goes out and tries to optimize how fast things go up. If your user experience needs to be something where you need to upload the file as fast as possible and you're not worried about the transaction costs, you'll spend an extra, you'll burn a couple API calls on it, you don't want to use this. There are studies that the folks in the Azure team have done that show that files will upload faster if you do more blocks at once. So simultaneous uploads are good. If you have lots of little smiles and you want to optimize that, this is not the path you want to go down. If you're okay with waiting a little bit extra and waiting, still a normal amount of time, and you want to minimize costs, then you can use this upload from stream, which will break everything into 4 megabyte chunks, and then in parallel, upload those 4 megabyte chunks into Azure. Okay? So it's, again, think about what your architecture is going to be doing and what you want it to do. And then the upload from stream, like I said, it does the upload. We can watch how many bytes we upload, and it'll just keep going, and it spins through all my files inside that directory, making sure everything's in sync. It also creates all the different file names. If you're not aware of this, every container in Azure has a single name, and when you want to mimic directory structures, you just give a big long string with slashes separating the parts, and then it can mimic directory structure if you want to. If you ever look at the storage and what's living in there, so go to Server Explorer, look at my development one, look at my blobs, got the container called Tech Days, and we look at the names of these things. You'll see the name is in Tech Days slash, and then this big long name here. This is just, you know, mimicking directory structures, in case you weren't familiar with that. There is no other parallels that you can really achieve with files other than, or any other benefits other than make sure they get broken into 4 megabyte blocks before you upload them. Any questions on that? Okay. There are also table storage transactions. This is the area where if you're interested in using a NoSQL style database, Azure provides one. And for table storage, what the transactions do is they allow you to do things like an insert, update, or delete. You get one of these per group or table to the same partition. So what you can actually do is I can take a bunch of things that I want to delete or insert or whatever. So long as I'm modifying the same table with the same partition key, Azure will execute those as one under one transaction. So I can do a bulk update. For queries, these depend on the size of the result set and the time that it takes to create things. So what you'll get is one transaction per 1,000 entities or per 30 seconds. The reason why this is in place is that Azure is trying to make sure that everybody who's playing on the platform is playing nicely. So what will happen is if you have a particular transaction or a query against the table storage that runs for a really long period of time and only gets a few records every time you run because it's poorly formed or it's just doing something so complex, Azure is going to give you 5 seconds of CPU time and 30 seconds of wall time before a response comes back. And it'll give you whatever it found in that 5 seconds of execution or 30 seconds of wall time as a result. It will give you, or if it finds 1,000 entities, it'll return sooner. So as soon as it has 1,000 whatevers in its list, that stuff comes back. Again, this is just important to understand that when you're doing things like, for example, places where this can get you are if you're taking your tables and you're doing your initial population. For example, all of us have applications that requires, or minutes, or not all of us, most of us will have an application that requires somebody to put in their address. Because very few of us have applications that only run for our country, we have to get the user to do two things. Pick the country they live in, and then pick whatever the local variant of state, province, or territory happens to be. You know, the thing that's bigger than a city, smaller than a state, or smaller than a country, that unit of measure, they all have to enter those things. And so what you'll see a lot of times is that you have to populate that data ahead of time. One of the things you'll want to consider doing is, you know, first off, how do you represent the data? What's the easiest way to do it? Is your application the easiest way to populate the stuff where you think, I will take the country, populate all of its states, move to the next country, populate all of its states? Maybe that's the easy way to do it. Another thing might be, I'll take all of my countries, push those in, take all the states, territories, whatever, push those in, so I can do things in two transactions or two transactions per country. Again, you just have to figure out what is the thing that makes the most sense for your application. So I've got another app that I wrote that's actually part of a demo that I'm working on for App Fabric Caching. And one of the things I wanted to do in here is I wanted to set up my data stores. And it was exactly the scenario that we're talking about where I want to enable someone that when they pick a country, will quickly pull up the list of states that they have as well. So set that as a startup. And for this particular instance, what we're going to do, and here's where this one here, connecting to the repository is not the interesting part. It's actually in the save here. So what I do is I instantiate my countries. Their countries right now are all hard-coded in the application. I've got the list for Australia, for Canada, and for the United States. I picked those primarily because, if you haven't guessed, I'm not speaking to you in Dutch. English is my primary language, so I picked things that I knew I could read and I was sure I wasn't typing in some joke from Wikipedia. So what we're doing here is I chose the option if I wanted to make sure that when a country gets sent into here, that country is committed correctly. So what I did is I call this, we have the data context. Again, I'm assuming that you're familiar with Azure. If not familiar with Entity Framework, it's basically the same idea. I have a data context. I add things to the context. When I'm ready to save stuff, that's when I tell the context, okay, everything you know about that's changed, push it out. So here I added the entry, and then on the country I called save changes. The important bit in here is that I told it to save the changes as a batch. What this does under the covers is it's going to make one API call into Azure to store things. Now right now I'm storing this all locally again, but same notion would happen elsewhere. And then for all the provinces that we see, I'll loop through all those. And then again, save changes batch. The reason why I'm pointing this out is not, again, none of this code that I've showed you so far is rocket science. None of this stuff is hard to understand. But the important thing is that when you're doing code review for your fellow coworkers, or you're doing just a sanity check after all the late night coding session, does what I just wrote make sense still? You can look for things and say, when I'm saving changes to a table, I remember that Scott said I should make sure that I should try to put everything in the same partition, in the same table, into a batch that will reduce the number of transactions I have. What's going to happen when you go out and you start testing the application, your testing bill, unless you're doing load testing, isn't going to be very big. When your application gets popular, or if you're an enterprise, the fact that you publish the application makes it popular. you'll all of a sudden start seeing your charges go up and down. And one of the things you'll want to watch out for again is, are there simple things like this that you could have done? Because you'll wind up with these simple things, the one bit that I would say you should be doing is, if you are not using things like the repository pattern today, where you have a single entity that's responsible for saving things, a single class that saves things of all the same type, now might be the time to invest in the repository pattern. People familiar with repository? Okay, yeah, and for those of you who aren't familiar with repository, it's a class that has methods on it like save state, get state, delete state, you know, just things to manipulate your different data. And anytime you need to manipulate those things, it goes through the repository instead of being built into the business object itself. Your business objects that know your business logic should not know how to save themselves or retrieve themselves. If you remember that little bit, you'll have repository down 90% of the way. And by doing that, like I said, you'll be able to write things like this that make sure that you're updating things correctly. So stop debugging. That's really the interesting bit in here. I did the same thing for the save. That's the only place I did that in. So when you're estimating costs, there are some things you're going to do. So we've talked about how do you write the code the right way. When you write your code the right way, what's going to happen is you've done things like where you minimize the impact that you're going to have everywhere else. But what's going to happen is your CFO or somebody else is going to eventually ask you, okay, now that you want to go to Azure, how should we figure out what this thing's going to cost us? At this point, big place where I like to look at this today is web applications or storage applications. Just understand, if we're all being good developers, we're doing threat models, and we're putting down where are the entry points into our applications. If we have a threat model, what we do is we take that list of entry points, and then we can take those exact same list and say, how many times will people call into these things? And based on how many times people will call into these things, you can then take those entry points and trace through about how many Azure calls you'll have. There's no point in being precise. If you think that there are between 14 and 16 calls that you do per time that you go through this thing, call it 16. There's no need to actually be super precise, though you can go ahead and instrument your code if you want to. Probably not very valuable. Once you estimate number of calls per path through those entry points, you'll then estimate how many times do each of those pages get called per month. So, for example, if you have a landing page, and the landing page is using assets that are stored in Azure for storage, page banner, footer, some buttons, figure out about how many times per month someone's going to come in. And again, these can be back-of-the-envelope calculations just to get an idea. At the end of your first month, you'll have a very specific notion of how frequently everything gets called. And what you do is you say, for example, if it's the landing page, and I have 1,000 people inside my enterprise, and they go to this page every time they open up IE, the average person opens up Internet Explorer or Firefox or whatever 6 times a day. I have 6 times 1,000 per day, 20 work days a month, so I'm going to be hitting, you know, these assets, 120,000 times the number of assets on the page. I've got a number. You do this for all your pages, and you will be able to tell your CFO how much this costs. What your CFO is probably going to do is he's going to take these numbers. He's going to also say, what else do you give me with this? So what kind of agility do I get? And you explain, well, when we get, you know, when the salespeople come into the office twice a year, we'll be able to handle all of them as well. Or if it's, you know, when a conference launches, we can handle all of those people as well. Microsoft uses this. They have a thing called the Give campaign. And with their Give campaign, what they do is they say for one month, people say where they want to put money for charities. And Microsoft uses the Give campaign to figure out what their total financial obligation is going to be for the year, because Microsoft does very aggressive employee matching for giving. When I worked there, it was $10,000 per person per year that they would match. And there were a lot of years, and because they matched so heavily, my giving actually went up. It was about twice what it is today, just because of the fact. But anyhow, what they did with that particular Give campaign is they knew that during the year, people would be checking out their charities, and they'd run things on a local box sitting in the corporate network. When the Give campaign kicked off, they poured the whole thing to Azure, and they would run it there for the month because they had 79 or 80,000 employees hitting this application all the time. So that's one of the things you can tell your CEO or CFO is, look, we will be able to give you all these things. And what he's going to do, he's going to go to whoever's in charge of IT in your data center, and they're going to say, Scott just told me that he could do this for me. What can you do? It's a good, and it's not a competitive thing. It's so that the person can understand what are they getting out of this. Again, for your estimations, then remember, for every 1 million calls you have, that's a buck. For every gigabyte that you plan that's going to be transferred in, again, you can measure these on your pages, and you can actually measure this on your pages very exactly, because you can go ahead, open up tools like Firefox. I know Firefox has this in there. I don't know if IE9 has this yet. And you can actually see how big was the page I just delivered, how much data had to be brought down to generate this thing. From that, you can just go to each page you need to estimate, multiply out the cost to figure out how many gigabytes you're downloading, and you can factor that into your estimation as well. Fairly quickly, you'll have some numbers to present to somebody. And then it's a question of what machine sizes do you need? Because then you'll know, I need to run so many transactions, it takes so long. Do I want beefier boxes or smaller ones to scale to do my stuff? Okay, that's that part. Now, another part that's a little bit more nebulous to some folks is SQL Azure pricing. SQL Azure is a bit hard to figure out, because one of the things you'll find is that today, when you, if you want to port something off to the cloud because you want to use tools you know and everything else, maybe you have data that is relational that you need to maintain referential integrity across nodes, you're going to wind up using SQL Azure. And it's a bit odd. So some of those things actually didn't format right. I'll fix these before I give the slides over to the organizers. This is right. So if in SQL Azure, what you do is you actually get charged per gigabyte that you have in use, or per unit that you have in use. When you're buying web databases, you're buying units of 1 gigabyte. The max size of the web database that can go from 1 to 5 gigabytes, that's really just a max size setting on your database instance, just like you would have in regular old SQL Server. What Microsoft bills you on is how many price point units you have. So if you have a business database, the unit size is 10 gig. If you have a web database, it's 1 gig. They then charge you based on these things, so how many do you have? So if I have a web database that is 1.1 gigabytes in size, I get charged for 2 units at about $20 a month. If I have a business database that's 16 gig, I get charged for 2. If I have 20.0000001 gigabytes, that's 3 units, and I'll get charged about $300 a month. Again, so there are some nice things about SQL Azure. If you're not aware of what SQL Azure does, it's high availability. It's really nice. So if you have any departmental applications where you're currently using Access or some shared machine, that when the cleaning staff unplugs the machine so they can plug in their vacuum cleaner and the machine goes down and you have sales execs yelling at you, this is one way to handle that, is to move it up to the cloud instead. It gives you high availability, which means it's going to be redundant, because again, there's very few of us who have an IT manager who will authorize setting up high availability on SQL Server for a 1 gig database. But you have lots of sales managers who will pay $10 a month so that their people aren't left out of the out in the cold. Anyhow, so when you're architecting for SQL Azure, just understand how things are set up. Also, what this will do here for your application architecture is it will tell you that if you have any dead records or dead data, you'll want to be more aggressive about pruning that out. And you might need to keep the historical data for historical reasons, for regulatory reasons, for just because your business says it's a good idea. But then think about taking that data that you're no longer really using and pushing it into some other storage option like table storage, which is going to charge you $0.15 per gigabyte per month instead of $10 per gig per month. Again, it's about the cost side of these things. The other thing to note here is that everything that goes into SQL Azure or into Azure in general is billed on the data transfer rate. So it's 10 gig in, 10 cents per gigabyte in, 15 cents per gigabyte out in North America and Europe, 20 cents per gigabyte in Asia. And there's no charge if the data is moving around the same data center. Quotas here are you can get 150 web edition databases. That includes the mandatory unbillable master database. So technically, you only get 149 business web edition databases. You're going to have up to 15 business edition databases. And you can do up to 10 terabytes of transfer per month. So again, these are just some things to know about when you're building your pricing model. Can my application actually handle this? The way that they handle data transfer is they're actually authenticating against a particular account. They're trying to figure out what account owns the data that's coming in. So all the Azure infrastructure, when you're connecting into their data centers, the first thing they do is they see, who is this? Then they measure the block size, and they bill that against your account. Then the data goes to whatever service it was supposed to go to, and that billing data isn't watched anymore because they already billed you for the 4 megabytes. Once they allow the 4 meg in, they don't care anymore. Once they're being asked to push 5 gig out on your behalf, they don't care anymore once they identify who it was that wanted that data pushed out. So, like I was saying before, on a bill, you'll get about 149 of these, maximum of 149 times 5 line items on a bill. They actually bill each 1 gigabyte unit. They've changed the billing on Azure a couple times on me. They used to bill it as 1 gigabyte units as separate line items. They now do it a little bit differently. They try to batch them up when they can. Your actual charges on these things, the important bit is that they're based on your daily usage. So if today I have a 20 gigabyte database and tomorrow that database is gone, I don't pay $200 for the month. I pay 1/30th of $200 for the day, which is going to be right around $7 or $8. And I'm doing this all in US. I apologize for that. If it's confusing, I can try to start guessing euros. But you probably, you know. I think this is one of the few places, too, where a US dollar does not equal a European Union euro, which is also nice. Your actual charges, they're all based on your daily usage. So as usage goes up, you can get things done. Now, what has happened here is people have needed to do things like, I need to use a throwaway database for 2 days to do a bunch of analysis. Instead of talking to your DBA to get this database, instead what you can do is for $20, you can rent a $500 a month unit. It's highly available, which makes sure you won't lose your work. You load the thing up with data, do your analysis, tear the thing down, fairly inexpensive. And lots of companies are doing this kind of stuff. They're using, again, it's just for basic analysis. If I need to analyze a bunch of data from scientific purposes, instead of procuring and installing SQL Server across dozens of machines, I go to Azure, I provision dozens of instances of SQL Azure, load up my data, do my analysis, get my answer, write my paper, throw it away. Again, here with the costs, think about how you want to use this and understand that you're not paying per month, you're actually paying here per day. Most everything else that you have in Azure is paid per second. This is the only thing where you pay based on the full day unit. And so here are the actual costs then. So if it's a 31-day month, it's costing me 32 cents a day. If it's a 30-day month, it costs me 33 cents. If it's a 28 or 29-day month, it goes up again, right? So the basic, if you want to remember it in your head, it's 32 cents per day for a 31-day month. Add 1 penny for every day over. And you're right on. Or for every day under, I should say. And this cost just scale by 10 if I'm using business databases. The final place that I haven't talked about is App Fabric and where those costs come from. So App Fabric has a number of services. We've already learned that caching is supposed to launch presumably tomorrow, I guess. There's the service bus, which allows you to do remote messaging in between two disconnected endpoints, allows you to do queuing. And there's this thing called the access control service, which allows you to do authentication. These all have billing models built into them as well. The nice thing about caching is that when you include this in your application, you can offset other costs. That demonstration that I was showing you before with the App Fabric bits, where I was showing you the table storage, one of the things I was doing to offset the costs was I was actually storing the states and the countries inside of the cache service. That way, whenever I needed to get the data a second or a third or a fourth time, because I was anticipating a site that would have lots of orders being entered and lots of addresses, I wouldn't have to hit the table service all the time, which meant I could bring my cost down there by spending a little bit extra on memory. When you're building your applications, it's all about trade-offs, right? That's what architecture is about. The other benefit of caching is that it can speed up my applications. If I have data that's read-heavy, why not store it in the cache so I can get the information a lot faster? As a matter of fact, the caching also supports the notion of having a local cache. If my local instance has asked for this data from the cache within the last 5 minutes, don't go all the way to the cache, just use my memory to give me the information. Caching supports that. What you'll see whenever you integrate caching with your applications is you'll also see a linear speed up for quite a while because of the fact that you're not going to be encountering delays based on network saturation or based on saturation of your database, where your database just can't handle any more transactions per second. Caching costs. As you can see in the cost column, I was hoping that the announcement would have happened yesterday. It didn't, so no word yet. Rumor has it that the cost will be announced at launch soon. But the sizes that you have available to you are anywhere between 128 meg and 4 gigabytes. If you ever want to make sure that you've got the numbers memorized, it starts out at 128 and doubles until you get to 4 gigabytes. The strategy here for managing your cache is that you're going to want to monitor how much load you're having on your servers. You're going to want to figure out, and then once you monitor the load, actually even in the cache, like how much of the cache is being used, you'll then use that information to figure out when you should either upgrade or downgrade. This is one of those places where your IT people who might be threatened by the cloud, you can point to them and say, look, I don't want to do this job. You need to watch this and figure it out. They're going to have new roles in the new cloud world. We don't lose our IT people. They just do more interesting things. For example, here, let's say you choose to use the cache for session state because that's the smart thing to do. You don't want to use SQL Azure, too expensive. You don't want to use a session server because it's too hard to get the session state server to be found on the Azure network. Instead, you can use caching. When you have your cache set up for session state, the thing you're going to want to look at is how full is this thing? One of the bits that you don't want to have happen in a cache is have the data that you're looking for get kicked out of the cache. The caching service uses a high watermark, low watermark algorithm to figure out when to eject information. When the high watermark gets hit, which is about 99% full, it starts forcibly ejecting data using a least recently used algorithm until it gets down to 80% in use. So the least recently used 20% of the cache will get ejected as soon as it hits the high watermark. If you don't want that kind of stuff to happen, if you don't want the ejection to actually come in and start killing sessions you care about, you've got to make sure the cache is big enough. To do that, what you'll be doing is you'll be watching, first, how big is my session state? And then how long do I expect somebody to stay logged in? And then you'll just watch that information. And when you start noticing that your number of users has grown to a point where you're hitting the high watermark fairly easily, you buy more cache. There's also this thing called the service bus. With the service bus, what they do here is they charge you per connection. It's normal bandwidth costs, and what happens is these connections themselves are charged per second. Nice thing about it is that it is a pay-as-you-go model, so it's about 1/10,000th of a cent if you buy on the pay-as-you-go model. You can cut that cost in half if you buy connections in bundles. I wound up learning about how this works in a fairly stressful way. Back in December, I was busy trying to figure out how well does this thing in the service bus called the eventing service work. Eventing is a pub-sub thing. I can have many publishers, many subscribers. They all talk to each other. Published documentation said that they have 20 subscribers, 60 users. If you exceed those maximums, bad things happen. I've known Microsoft documentation to be off by a lot and tell people fibs just so they don't abuse things too much. I was curious if the stuff was actually implemented as they said. So what I did in the caching service is I implemented something and I created one subscriber, two, and I kept going up to 20. And I said, great, I've got 20 subscribers right now. And then when I get to 21st, it broke. I thought, okay, so they probably were telling truth in the documentation. How many subscribers can I have? And I was looking at the cost, and I thought, you know, I can probably handle this. So I'll just go ahead and test things out. And then I promptly forgot about how much this stuff claimed to cost, which when you read the documentation, says $3.99 per month as you go. And at that point in time, did not mention the real pricing model of per second. So if you weren't using something for a particular second, you weren't charged. And I started going up, and I thought, well, my wife's going to kill me if she sees how many I've used, but it's for important stuff, and I'll get paid more than what this is worth, so I'll keep going. And after making that decision, just went nuts, got to 60 connections, 61, 62, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000. I got to 10,000. I was so troubled by this that I wrote a note off to Microsoft saying, hey guys, I got to 10,000 transactions. Your documentation's crap. And someone else who was on the thread with me said, Scott, have you read the documentation and where did you get $40,000 to spend on an experiment? So my heart's somewhere down in my stomach. I'm picturing my wife with a knife cutting various parts off of me. And I panic. I talked to one of the guys who's actually the keynoter here, Wade, and I said, Wade, I don't have 40 grand. Please, man. And so after doing that, eventually got put in touch with Clemens, and Clemens Vasters goes, oh, by the way, Scott, it's really 1/10,000th of a cent. This is how the billing model really works. It's unfortunate that we didn't phrase it that way. So sorry you didn't sleep last night. Anyhow, so yes, and by the way, the result of that experiment wound up being, I found out some other interesting things. When you are doing your connections, if you want to have multiple publishers going to the exact same endpoint and they all live in the same app domain, they share a connection. My 10,000 all lived on separate threads in the same application. I got charged for one connection for 2 minutes. It's nothing. I got my 20 connections going up were all in the same process. Because the 20 subscribers were all subscribers and not publishers, they got a unique connection each. So in total, for a 2 minute period the experiment was running over a couple of hours, but I think I wound up racking up about 2 or 3 minutes of charges. I was getting charged for about 24, 25 concurrent connections at worst. And that was based on some other things I've been doing as well. So just so you know, if you're all, there's your subscribers, they get charged per connection. Your publishers get charged per app domain. The connection thing itself does very smart things at the app domain level to make sure that you're not getting overly billed. So that's another interesting thing. If you have a bunch of topics from one app domain, go ahead. It'll work. So how do you estimate these costs? What you do is you look out at how many subscribers are you going to have, how many publishers will you have, and then you have to figure out how many concurrent connections will you have. With things like eventing, you're actually better off having a pattern where you create the connection, send the message, kill the connection. By doing that, you're actually freeing up the connections for other folks so they can use them. And yes, it does cost a little bit to set the thing up and go back and forth. There are some bandwidth costs in here as well, so every time you authenticate, you're paying, again, at the gate that goes into Azure saying, here's more at your 10 cents per gigabyte. So anyhow, what you'll do there is you want to estimate how much bandwidth you have, how many messages do you expect, and how many calls do you think will be coming in based on your ingress and egress, and that's what you present to people, and they ask you, how much will this cost? The strategy around preparing for this, then, is what you're going to do is you will prepay for your average load. Over here, I mentioned that you can buy these connections in bundles at $1.99 per connection, based on 5, 25, up through 500. And yes, you can negotiate different numbers if you contact a Microsoft sales rep directly. These are the numbers that you get when you go through the website. My understanding is that you can talk to sales and they will give you different values. So you can buy 5,000 concurrent if you wanted to. Prepay for what you believe your average load will be. And then just go to on-demand for bursts. If you want to figure out when does it make sense to commit to a connection for a whole month, think of it this way. If I think that I will be using this connection for at least 50% of the month, why not go buy the connection ahead of time? It's going to cost you the same amount either way. It's either going to be $1.99 at wholesale or $1.99 when you prepaid. You don't lose. The access control service is yet another one that you may want to build in. Client I'm at right now, what we're doing is we're looking at using the access control service for doing authorizations. We're looking at a situation where we're going to have about 3 million authorizations per day. At 3 million authorizations per day, it's still going to be less expensive than if we built the infrastructure on our own and hosted it and paid for everything else that goes around it. What we did there is we just said, how many authorizations are we going to do per month? We said it's going to be about 90 million. Okay, we'll pay for that. And 90 million is basically $1.99 times, you can do the math. It's just not that expensive. It's not that expensive in comparison, especially to the number of servers that we would have to get in place. And $90 million a month is what we were expecting for the first month. We're actually forecasting that we'll get upwards of about 500 million logins per month within a year. Again, it's a video on demand type service, so interesting stuff. Important things from this talk then are, just remember, all of us are building distributed applications. As a matter of fact, if you're not building a distributed application, I'd be curious what you're working on. Even those of us building mobile applications are doing distributed apps, because we have our phone talking back to a server that's doing something interesting. Infrastructure, again, it's expensive. It's expensive whether Microsoft provides it or you provide it. The question is, do you want all the other issues associated with maintaining that hardware, with figuring out what's the best way to cool this stuff? Interesting thing that I've been hearing about lately, there's a guy over at Amazon named James Hamilton. James is one of the brilliant guys who was originally on the Azure team, helped them design their container model, then went over to Amazon Web Services, which is not a big change since he lived in Seattle anyhow, and now he works on Amazon. And James pushes out a lot of papers about interesting things that are happening in data center cooling. There are companies out there who are figuring out what it actually costs if a server fails versus how much it costs to cool the data center. Your company probably isn't running these analyses, instead is running their data centers between, I'm going to do it in Fahrenheit because this is where I remember the numbers, between 60 degrees Fahrenheit and 75 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a fairly cool room. I believe that's maybe 14 degrees Celsius. There are companies who have already figured out that the failure rates of putting a data center in the desert in Saudi Arabia, open air and no cooling whatsoever, just decent ventilation and fans, it will be cheaper to do that than to run, you know, and replace the units, than to keep replacing things. As a matter of fact, they're starting to find out that most of today's hardware can run at about 90 degrees Fahrenheit or about 30, 32 degrees Celsius and still be fairly happy. The interesting thing here is that the infrastructure costs that these data centers are driving down, they're actually going to be able to reduce their costs quite a bit, which means that they may be coming in even below your costs. Final thing is that these cloud bits, it does mean thinking about the cost-benefit trade-offs of your choices. Where are you going to give the customer a better end result? Where are you going to give the business a better end result? Which, in this scenario, is more important to you? And the final thing is that there's a lot of things to think about here. When you and I developed applications 5-10 years ago, we didn't think about how much all the hardware cost. What I would do is I would go out and I would tell my project sponsor, he'd say, I want this thing built. He'd say, Scott, what do I need to run this? And I would say, well, you need this many SQL servers, this many this other thing. And then I'd go to the IT guy and he'd say, no, we need redundancy as well, so let's add on to that. We need more network switches. And they'd come up with a number, and I never worried about the number. I just told them what to buy. I never worried about what the stuff cost. Because of what's happening today with the cloud and everything else, the cost information is coming down to us. When we talk back to the CEO, CFO, or whomever else, we shouldn't just be presenting to them what's the lowest cost alternative. We don't think about that in our personal lives. We will go out and buy the thing that's the slightly better car, the slightly better bicycle, because the extra features give us something extra that we don't need but we want. Or maybe we need these things, and by paying a little bit extra, we do better. When we present things to the CEOs and CFOs, we need to present to them, if we do this, it will cost this much. If we do this other thing, it will cost more, but we get these benefits. You and I need to get used to having that conversation that we haven't had to have before, because in the past we just said, buy these things, and we never worried about the cost. Now we're worried about the cost, and we want to benefit the business. We shouldn't also be telling the business, go to the cheapest thing possible. Explain to them why a higher cost estimate might also be valuable. Those are some things just to think about as you're looking at the cloud. So any questions? Back? What about statistics regarding? I'm sorry, can you come closer? Yes. So the question is, if you have multiple customers and they're causing you to incur charges, how do you make them pay for their own usage? Now, there's a few ways that you can do. So the statistics that come in are that you would have. So yes, there are ways to do this. You can't actually make them pay for the bandwidth without making them get their own storage account. But if you allocate, like, for example, a storage account to that particular user, then what would happen is they would authenticate against that stuff. When you provision applications for that user, so let's say you own the intellectual property for an application, it's possible to then host an instance of that application for that user. And then what you do is you charge them a licensing cost for the application, and or maybe a monthly charge. And what you do is you just watch how much they incurred on Azure itself. So it's a, more of a deployment thing than anything else. The other thing you might want to do, too, is also watch, you know, page views and everything else. So you can use regular web monitoring software to analyze what's going on in your application to do a lot of this. And based on the data, you can do calculations to figure out how many rows do they have in the database and so on. But there's nothing that exists today. You'd have to either, like I said, the easiest way to do it is you give them their own deployment of your software that you manage. That's probably the easiest way to get it all. Any other questions? So back there, yeah. Okay, so I think I got, so if I'm right, just, the question is, how can I use the data that, does Azure provide the data that it's collecting so I can figure out what this application is going to cost me? And you want early access to the data. So the Azure does provide you with this, the information about what they're using to charge you. As a matter of fact, you can go ahead, and I should have some information on here. If I go to, so I think the real question is, what does the bill look like, and how soon do I find? What Azure does tell you is they won't tell you what the system has cost you so far today, but you can find out how many charges you incurred since midnight, since the previous day. So as soon as the new day begins, you don't get that data until the day ends. But let's just go ahead and, trying to pull up a quick bill. It's going to take me a moment. So you see here on the screen, there's this nice little link. When you log in, it says billing. So I go into billing. And this is great, too, because then it asks you to sign in yet again. Before signing in, select the country region where the services will be used. Continue. And then, yes, I did get redirected here. I am signed into Messenger. It's going to make me sign in again. And I do have a warning here that's time's up, so if, no need to be super polite unless you really want to see the bills. And I have two accounts here because I've got two different offers that I was able to get access to. I think I'm using the smaller number. And here, oh great. So nothing for me, I'm on the wrong account. The other thing that's happened, too, is that because MSDN customers get a lot of leeway for what they're doing, yeah, it's 4-1. Let's go back over here. I'll just go back to the view my bills. They do give you access to the usage, so I guess I've got some usage on here. Let's just see what the usage looks like. But again, because I'm an MSDN subscriber, that's another thing to note, is that if you are planning on doing this for your company, go get MSDN subscriptions for everybody working on Azure. It gives you about the equivalent of about $3,270 worth of usage per year against Azure, which is almost the cost of the subscription. So you basically break even if you want to do a lot of heavy testing against this. So it says, here's noting that I've got some AppFabric usage. I can go into the details and it says, for example, I consumed 0.44 units. I've got 10 included. at a rate of $1.89. So this is me testing against the axis control, and I've executed, this times 100,000, so about 440 requests against the access control service. Against the access control service since the 16th. And for the service bus, I've had a small number of connections against the darn thing. Because I've got a bunch of, and so these actually aren't included. I haven't racked up to a whole penny yet. Again, like I said, these are 10,000ths of a cent per second. I've been doing a lot of little stuff back and forth. I bring up the connection, I shut it down, I bring it up, I shut it down. So I haven't had a lot this month. But it does give you the detail, and like I said, it gives you the bill says from the 16th through today, so I can get daily usage. I can actually generate reports on based on a smaller time range if I need to. Any other questions? So when the hardware fails, you're not getting billed per minute when that stuff's not up, but we'll be speaking of another instance as soon as the failure is detected. So technically, it doesn't affect your billing at all because you just get billed more. It'll be constant as far as your point of view looks. As far as the data transfer in between different regions of the world, that's ingress-egress charges because you're leaving data centers and re-entering them. Microsoft doesn't have any pipes between, any wholly owned pipes between, like, say, Asia and North America. Just be ridiculous for them to do that. So, yeah, you will get charged for the synchronization in between. Other questions? If you guys think of any other questions while you're wandering around, or if you see me and want to get a business card, just say, Scott, I got some questions for you. I got a business card, or hit me up in the hallway. Email is scott@scottseely.com. I believe my email address is also available on the website. So feel free to ping me with other questions about how this stuff works. Okay, thank you very much.